Welcome to this episode of Season 5 of The Common Bridge, where policy and current events are discussed in a fiercely nonpartisan manner. The host, Richard Helpe, is a philanthropist, entrepreneur, and political analyst who has reached over 4 million listeners, viewers, and readers around the world. With our surging growth in audience and subscriptions, The Common Bridge continues to expand its reach. The show is available on the Substack website and the Substack app. Simply search for The Common Bridge. You can also find us on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. The Common Bridge draws guests and audiences from across the political spectrum, and we invite you to become a free or paid subscriber on your favorite medium.
Hello and welcome to The Common Bridge. I'm Brian Krueger, the producer of the show. Just letting you know that this is a two-part episode, Rich's conversation with Beth Bourne. The second part of the conversation, the conclusion, will air on April the 16th. So let's join their conversation now.
Hello, welcome to The Common Bridge. I'm your host, Rich Helpe. Today we have a very important and very sensitive topic with a woman that's been on the front lines. You might want to caption it as transgender rights. You might want to caption it as transgender ideology, and there's other descriptions, of course. So we welcome today from Northern California, Beth Bourne. Beth, welcome to The Common Bridge, and thank you so much for taking time to tell us your story and your experience.
Thank you for having me.
Beth, our audience on The Common Bridge, our listeners, our readers, and our viewers like to know a little bit about our guests. So if you don't mind, maybe a little biography. Where did you spend your early days, and maybe what's your career and personal arc been like, and what's brought you to this day today?
Sure. Well, I am in my early 50s. I have two kids. I grew up overseas. My father was with a U.S. Embassy, so we did live internationally. I had conservative parents who are down in San Diego. I myself, in college, became a liberal and have been a registered Democrat for 30 years. And so that's what sort of makes this an interesting story, is that I have always been on the progressive left. But when my daughter, back in 2018, began to identify as transgender, it really made me question, where are we going with some of these views that are coming, I believe, more from the left side around gender ideology. I work for the university here in my town, and I'm surrounded by other liberal parents because I'm in a blue city in a blue state here in Davis, California. But yeah, that's sort of where I'm at.
When did your daughter first come to you with the notion that she was indeed a boy and not a girl? How old was she?
So she would have been 13. 2 years earlier, she declared that she was bisexual. And at the time, I didn't realize that all of these terms in the LGBTQIA+, these definitions were being introduced here in the public schools. So I think that's maybe an important part of the story, is that, you know, as young as fifth, sixth grade, kids are being asked in schools to label their sexual preferences, and then also their gender identity. And so when she made the announcement to me, it was 2018, so almost 6 years ago when she was 13.
So Beth, if I understand what you're saying, that when your daughter was 11 years old in the public school as part of her curriculum, unbeknownst to you as a parent, that she was being asked whether she was a heterosexual, lesbian, bisexual, or perhaps something else at 11 years old?
It's correct. You know, I don't think people are aware, and I wasn't, of course, until just the last couple of years, but we have a whole new kind of curriculum that's coming in through the science class starting in fifth and sixth grade, as well as the library books, you know, picture books, books, you know, in the elementary school, that really give a message to kids that, you know, there's so many options that they can choose from. And I think they're trying to be open-minded and let kids know maybe that that there's these other identities or other sexualities, but I personally believe it's too young for children to get introduced to these ideas, and that it leads to some confusion around, their teen years or their puberty, adolescent years, where they should really be exploring who they are and not setting these labels at this really young age. So, I think that's where some of the confusion comes, is that we're asking children to sort of give labels to themselves at a young age.
You know, I recall at that time of life, you know, we had basically classes on reproduction, and the, you know, young women went into one room and young guys went into another one, and we learned about reproductive health and, you know, how babies were made. And gosh, at that time, we didn't even talk about how to prevent what was then called venereal disease. So I've heard lots of support coming out for, you know, including President Biden saying he supports gender affirming care. And you, though, as a parent, saying, gosh, how do they even know? And yet we've got this medicalization complex coming at them gangbusters. I need some help bridging that gap. How do you get from an 11-year-old being asked a question that they don't understand to the weight of the presidency of the United States with our current president and the whole medical industrial complex coming at them? Doesn't seem like a very fair fight to me, but I must be missing something.
That's so true. And I'm a liberal, so I've always supported our public schools and our unions and our democratic local officials and, you know, up through our president. But I didn't realize that this, and I want to call it, you know, radical gender ideology, right? The idea that human sex is no longer binary and immutable, and that human beings can now change their sex using experimental drugs and surgery. So I did not realize that it was being introduced not only at the higher level with, you know, world organizations like the HRC and the ACLU, but then also, you know, within our school system, it came down through the California Teachers Association, so the teachers union at the state level, and then it came through at the local level through our teachers union as far as doing the trainings. And then the materials just all came in through our Department of Education here in California. So we have a very super majority, you know, at the state level with the Democrats. So it's very easy for them to bring in new curriculum and new policies. But I had no idea it was sort of like, you know, the assault on children and their reality was at all levels of government and throughout the school system. So there was really no way to opt out. You know, I didn't know at the time in 2018, but even now it's almost impossible to opt out your child, you know, pull them out of the curriculum that has to do with gender and sexuality, because it's pervasive in all areas of the school.
You know, look, we want to be a free and open and supportive society. And, you know, that's part of our Constitution, to strive for a more perfect union. And indeed, we've been imperfect. That, you know, we all know the history of slaves. We all know about women's suffrage. So marginalized groups looking to get a voice. And, you know, clearly when we go to the Civil Rights Act, you can say there's a wrong that we were trying to right. We look at the Voting Rights Act, there's wrongs we were trying to right. In that context, what goals were being pursued or what wrongs were attempted to be right? How is this explained to you as a citizen, a parent, and a taxpayer?
So I think what they've done is they've sort of jumped on the bandwagon for some of these other, you know, civil rights issues, right? And so when the same-sex marriage was passed so easily, we had all these organizations that had been formed around fighting for that. And so you had all the strength within these organizations that needed to keep, you know, fundraising and keep have a purpose. And so they picked the idea of, you know, let's fight for transgender rights. And that means for, you know, men who identify as women to be in our spaces, prisons, bathrooms, shelters. And then also this medical side of let's make sure that we can give kids, you know, and adults, these gender affirming, you know, the whole idea of giving experimental drugs and surgeries to minors as well as adults, that just became part of their rights, you know, like a civil rights movement. You know, and within the schools here in California, a big issue is that teachers and school counselors are allowed to socially transition a child at school. So if they hear a child comes up to their teacher and says, you know, can you please start using this new name? And I want to go by these new pronouns. You know, I want to use he, him, or he, they. And can you also please, you know, make sure you don't tell my parents because I'm not ready to come out to them, or they might not be supportive. And in California, we've actually, I don't think many parents realize this, but the schools will, you know, secretly transition a child at school. And they're saying it's because it's a privacy right that students have. But, you know, I would argue that parents should have the right to raise their child and keep them safe. So there's a lot happening within specific school districts here in California to fight that. But yeah, I think they really did try to say this is, you know, a civil rights issue, but it's actually taking away the rights of women. And I believe, and that's why I did this, you know, this expose with Kaiser, is that the medical side of it is harming, you know, vulnerable people and young kids' bodies. And it's making a profit for the gender industry.
Indeed. And the excellent investigative journalism you did about your own experience with Kaiser. And I do recommend everybody read that. Where can people find the article you wrote about your experience with Kaiser?
You know, it was published by Colin Wright. He's a PhD evolutionary biologist. He actually got a degree from UC Davis and the University of California at Santa Barbara. And he was kind of canceled from academia for speaking out on this while he was a postdoc, I believe, at Penn State. So he has a Substack or a publication called Reality's Last Stand. His name is Colin Wright, and it's published under my name there. So Beth Bourne. And I think if you just go to Kaiser, non-binary mother or something like that, you would find it.
So Colin Wright, Reality's Last Stand, on Substack and other sites, and where he's been writing about this. And it sounds like he's very well qualified. And speaking of that, as a scientist, what does the science say? You know, I've done a lot of reading on this. I'm not a scientist, but I have to tell you, I have not been able to find a single citation of any study that says injecting kids with what is effectively chemical castration and foreign hormones, and then medicalization further with permanently altering surgeries, does anything. And in fact, the opposite, if you look at England, the National, their health service said that it doesn't do any of the so-called good, like stopping suicidal ideation. But I'm not up to speed on all the science. What does the science say that you might be exposed to?
Well, that was an excellent summary. You know, I didn't realize that the science books here in my children's schools, here in California, they adopted a new science book, biology, and a new AP biology, so advanced placement biology. And within these biology books, they actually put language that says that scientists are just discovering this new, you know, idea that we have transgender people. And then they give a definition that being transgender means the doctor, when they assigned your birth, that they, you know, made a mistake and that you are actually, you know, where you were born in a boy body, but you're actually a girl, or, you know, a girl body who's actually a boy. So they put this definition in the science textbooks. And I have a very intelligent child. And so for them to read something that looks, you know, it's in the science book, it's in black and white, you know, they're being tested on it. It'd be hard for a young person not to think that there's some truth behind it. But, you know, I like you're saying, there is no science that shows that mammals or humans can change their biological sex. It wouldn't make any sense. You know, we've had evolution for 4 billion years. So why would we all of a sudden have this huge number of kids, you know, identifying as being transgender?
Well, hermaphroditism is indeed a scientific-based condition. You know, people that have both male and female genitalia that, you know, even at a chromosomal level, it's hard to discern. It's very rare. And there are people that get into adulthood and decide that they want to live as the opposite gender. Personally, you know, a mentally competent adult, as far as I'm concerned, can do whatever they want to do. And that's where I come back to, what's the distress that these changes in educational program are trying to solve? Did we have an epidemic of children saying that they were going to harm themselves or other people if they didn't go through this treatment, or they were being maltreated in some way? What was the societal objective for bringing these programs into children, 11-year-old children? What have you been told in your investigation of this?
Well, I'll go back to that, but real quickly on the idea of intersex being sort of evidence that we have transgender people. You know, that's what they presented in my daughter's science textbook, right? They say that we've had, you know, intersex DSM. You know, it's a variation in your sexual development. But even, you know, somebody who's intersex, you only can produce large gametes or small. So you only can produce eggs or sperm. So there is no sense of being intersex because your body only can produce one or the other. But they do give that as an example of how there's this spectrum of gender, because we have it, you know, intersex, which has really nothing to do with you know, your sexuality in the sense of, you know, do you produce eggs or sperm? But so going back to the idea of why do we have kids being told they might be transgender? You know, I've just been thinking about it myself. And I do think it, for the adults who want to live their lives in the opposite sex. So for men who, you know, would like to be what we used to call in the past, you know, cross dressers or transsexual, or maybe, you know, not as common, but you might have women that like to dress in male attire or call themselves men. I think it's to give validity to what they're doing, right? You know, if we just say this happens when you're an adult because you enjoy wearing this other clothing or having this other appearance or having these you know, surgeries. If you could instead say, well, you know, it happens to children, you know, as young as, you know, we learned in Davis that as young as 2 years old, kids know that they are already in the wrong body. So, that's where I think it's coming from. It's to give the adults, you know, some kind of validity to say it happens to children. But if you're introducing a very, very, you know, you're almost leading kids to believe they could be in the wrong body because you're presenting all these ideas to them. And then you're, you know, in a classroom, you might have the flags for the Progress Pride flag. You might have, you know, pronoun pins being worn by the teachers and the paraeducators that have their pronouns announced. You might have, you know, all this material. And when a child comes out as being transgender at school, they get celebrated. So, you know, not only are you giving all these ideas and having the flags and the rainbows and the pronouns, but then you're also, when a child comes out, you know, this could be a child that's lonely or maybe, you know, just a quirky kid. They get all this attention that they might not have gotten otherwise. And so it's, you know, that's why to me, it doesn't seem like a safe situation for young people.
It hurts my heart to hear that they might be influenced like that. And before we get into talking about your experience with Kaiser, one of the pieces I read about you talked about something about a standard letter for your daughter. And I perked up at that phrase, like, what exactly is a standard letter?
So is that like the coming out letter that she gave me? Is that what you're thinking of?
Yeah.
Right. So when she was 13, she, you know, gave me a sealed envelope and she said, this letter's for you. And in the letter, and it, you know, it was handwritten. It said, Dear Mom, I want you to know that you know, I'm sharing this news with you. This is my new name. These are my new pronouns. I've spoken, you know, with my teachers and counselors. This is how I would like for you to treat me, and please, you know, let me share it with other people. That was the first letter. And then a week later, the letter said, you know, now that I've, you know, thought about this, I would also like to consider using, a breast binder and then getting on puberty blockers and testosterone, because I know that WPATH and Planned Parenthood, you know, they've said it's safe. So these two different kind of, I call them scripts almost, or templates that kids can find online. It's just a standard letter that they can use to write to their parents, or to other people, you know, share it with your grandparents. But the language is there for them, right? How do you make this big announcement? And then how do you let your parents know, or, you know, what other people in your life, from the counselors to the teachers and your pediatrician, what you want? So, a couple of years later, I realized how much this is just laid out for kids, what you need to do, you know, to transition. And if you have a child like mine, who's very hardworking and, a straight A student who likes to check things off the box and likes to be praised for doing good work and, you know, meeting her goals. And if you're in a really hard time in your life and you're looking for some direction, to have this checklist of how do I become, you know, transgender, a person of the opposite sex, I thought it was, you know, very seductive or alluring to her to have it laid out there for her like that.
Yeah, it sounds almost legalistic. And just a couple of things that I have been out trying to get, like trans law centers and people like that to come on the show and talk about their work and what they're up to. I have not been successful at getting anyone to accept an invitation yet. But for anybody that happened to be listening or reading or watching this, we'd love to have you on the show. You can reach the same audience and give us a counterbalance. And in recent days, now WPATH, which has been kind of setting a worldwide standard, has now backed off of the use of puberty blockers and synthetic hormones for underage youth. And it's, you know, Sweden, Finland, United Kingdom are closing their transgender operations for kids. And yet it seems to be on the upswing in the United States. So Beth, let's shift a little bit to your experience. So you had a notion that how hard would it be to get gender affirming care? And you thought maybe you'd just be a great investigative journalist, go undercover and see how hard or how easy it was. Now I see you sitting here. It must have been really hard, because I can't tell from this view whether you've had any work done, I guess, the way to put
right,
it.
Right, right.
Let's take me from the beginning of that. What did you decide to do, and what was the first step you took?
Okay, so this is going back to 2022, and my daughter was had just turned 17. And she'd actually, a few weeks earlier, had asked for no contact with me. So, and that's very common when these kids are in this kind of cult, where if you have a parent who doesn't affirm, you know, your transgender identity, that you should cut them off. So I'm just bringing that up because it gave me a lot of freedom to go this route with this investigative, you know, journalism that I was doing. And I also realized if she had just turned 17, that means a year from then, on her 18th birthday, she would be able to walk into the Kaiser Gender Clinic and have her top surgery or start, you know, testosterone or whatever procedure she wanted without any parents there. Because at 18.
Let's not mince words here. So top surgery.
Sorry, I should use the right word.
Her healthy breasts would be removed as if she were stricken with something horrible like breast cancer.
Right. It's a cosmetic bilateral mastectomy is the term we should be using. So that's another good question. Why are children learning in school about, you know, top surgery rather than learning, you know, the correct scientific or, you know, the medical term for what you're really doing to a young person. But that's not what they learn. They learn, you know, that there's top surgeries and bottom surgeries. Okay, but going back to 2022, when I first came up with this idea, I was, you know, worried about my daughter turning 18. And I got a letter from Kaiser that they were having a cervical cancer screening, you know, recommending that I have one done for individuals over 21 to 65 years old. And when I saw the language in there, this is a letter from my OBGYN, you know, kind of struck me is they're not even using the word woman to tell me that I need to come in for this cervical cancer screening, right? It's just saying an individual with a cervix. And so I kind of pushed back on this idea with my doctor. And I said, you know, why are you using this term? And she said, Kaiser wants to be inclusive of, you know, their trans patients and their gender fluid patients. And so, you know, I pushed back further and I said, can you please, you know, change the language to at least mention women? And, you know, when she said that they weren't going to make any changes, but that she had shared this information with their administrator, I just decided at that moment, you know, it was just like spur of the moment. I just said, well, then in that case, please change my records to show that I'm non-binary and I use they, them pronouns. And I would like to start, you know, looking into testosterone and top surgery. So I actually used that term. And so I got an email back within 45 minutes saying that my records had been changed and that they were, you know, there to help me meet my goals and that I'd be, you know, contacted soon by, it was my primary care physician. And so that's all it took to have my records changed. And I had the same experience with my daughter, you know, when she was 14 at a wellness visit with her, it was a visiting pediatrician. My daughter was sick with dizziness. And when they overheard my ex-husband use these he, him pronouns to address my daughter, her pediatrician said, you know, to the parents in this very excited way, I hear you're using, you know, different pronouns. And then she looked at my daughter and said, does this mean you would like to have your records changed? And, you know, we can change your name. So I'd seen it done with my daughter. And they even, you know, that same visit, they said, you can go to a gender clinic here in Oakland called the Pride Clinic and have, it's a one-stop shop, you know, to meet with a gender specialist, a social worker, an OBGYN, and an endocrinologist. And I had called back and spoke, you know, in private to this pediatrician. I said, how dare you ever suggest my daughter medicalization, you know, without first discussing it with us. So I had seen that happen with my daughter, but, you know, I was surprised. I'm a 50, you know, 3-year-old woman that they would so quickly just change my records and then put me on this path of medicalizing my body. So that's sort of where it started. And it just was one step after the other where there was no, no concern about why I would be asking for these procedures, to, you know, to change my body, even though I kept bringing up these red flags of, you know, mental distress.
You know, one thing that I was curious about, like when someone goes in for cosmetic surgery, okay, whatever it might be, you know, it could be, you know, breast augmentation, could be eyelid lift. What do they call it when they pull your face back? Facelift. I know that the first question the plastic surgeon will ask is, what do you expect from this procedure? They want to know, like, do you have reasonable emotional and psychiatric expectations for this? Were you ever asked those questions?
You know, the question that they would ask me is what are your goals? And so, you know, the goals actually for all of these procedures, it's really just about your appearance, right? You know, that's what they're asking is if your goal, you know, and I could just, I don't know if you can see this.
But what did you tell them your goal was?
Oh, so, okay. So this is like an example for top surgery. It's like identifying your goals. Are your goals to have you know, flatness in your breast, to have nipple sensation, or, you know, because you're worried about scarring. So they're all, you know, appearance-based, except for the nipple sensation.
But that presumes you're going to have the procedure. Not, not whether you're going to have it, but when they ask you what your goals were, wasn't there a question about why would you want to have your healthy breasts removed? Like, did they ask you about that?
So I guess when they ask you for your goals, it's all about, you know, how do you want to look when this, you know, with this gender affirming care. And so when I met, it was actually the first mental health assessment. There's only two. The first one is, you know, an hour and a half. The second one is much shorter. That's all they do for, you know, a major surgery, you know, a mastectomy that's, you know, only cosmetic. And that's same for the phalloplasty, which is, you know, having a fake phallus or penis. I did that treatment too, or the, you know, the, I got the referral for it. But in this mental health assessment, she just asked me, you know, when I told her that I was non-binary, which, you know, non-binary, I don't really know how that's possible. You could not be, you know, a man or a woman, but I told them I was non-binary. And I think that gave me a lot of latitude really to make up whatever I wanted, right? Because in this case, you know, I said my goal as a non-binary person is to look more masculine, you know, and I said I have always been a really sporty, you know, young person. When I was a kid, I had three older brothers. I liked to ride motocross bikes. I helped my dad with mowing the lawn and working, you know, in the wood shop. So I just said I always felt more like, you know, I was kind of male. And so what I was asking from Kaiser was to make me look more male. And so I asked for testosterone so I could have some facial hair. And I then I asked if I could have, you know, a flatter appearance and look, you know, more masculine. But, you know, when I first started the call, she said, I want you to know that Kaiser has, you know, other gender affirming care that we could offer you. And she brought up body contouring. And then you can also have your face masculinized. You know, they can do these facial surgeries. And then she brought up the, they call it lower surgery.
Like, instead of saying, are you sure you want to do this? They're kind of upselling you.
This concludes part one of Rich's interview with Beth Bourne. Return on April 16th to hear the conclusion of this interview. And join us on Substack at Richard Helpy's The Common Bridge.
Thanks for joining us on The Common Bridge. Subscribe to The Common Bridge on Substack.com or use their Substack app where you can find more interviews, columns, videos, and nonpartisan discussions of the day. Just search for The Common Bridge. You can also find The Common Bridge on Mission Control Radio or your Radio Garden app.